some of those Pokemon, I swear they just dialed it in. One of the recent ones was literally a trash bag.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the tangled web of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, and is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us this week is Mozilla's Angelina Fabro. Angelina is on the developer tools team at Mozilla and recently gave a talk at GDC about building games for the web. Hi, Angelina.
Hey.
So our topic today, appropriately, by no coincidence, is about games on the web. Sort of the past, where we've come from, where we are today, and what the future looks like as far as, you know, how, what kind of game experiences are we able to have on the web, and what kind of great experiences can we create. So I thought a good way to start off, because it's sort of topical and recent, would be to ask Angelina a little bit about why were you at GDC? What was that like? And what were you up to there?
Right. So I suppose it's true that when you think of Mozilla, you don't necessarily think of video games as the first thing when you think about Mozilla. Usually it's something like Firefox. It might be Firefox OS since we're doing that recently. Not usually games. But of course, Mozilla Research has been working on the Asm.js project for the last couple years. And basically what we've been able to provide is JavaScript as a compile target. So you can take your code in C and C++ and compile it to JavaScript and run it in a web browser. And so what we did was we went to GDC and we brought some announcements with us about support for Asm.js in Unreal Engine 4, in Unity 5. We talked a little bit about those things with our partners. And then me personally, I was on stage talking about our in-browser tools for people that are doing JavaScript first development. So if you're not somebody writing C++ and then compiling to JavaScript and you're building first in the web as your first target for your, as you know, as a game platform, then you know, you would use our tools for debugging your 2D and 3D HTML canvas context, for example. So I got up there and gave like a demo, and we also had some other people from partners come up and talk as well. We had we had Jeremy from Trendy come up. They're responsible for Dungeon Defenders and Monster Madness, which I can talk about a little bit more later. We had some guys from the Goo Engine come up and talk about how they built their engine in the browser. And that was basically it. Yeah, we did a couple talks. We had people come by the booth. The most exciting thing, I think, for me being at the booth was people would come along and see the Unreal demo and they'd say, okay, well, you know, what is it that you're trying to show us here? And I'd explain about Asm.js. And so then they would say, oh, wait, so that's in the browser. And then I'd, you know, unhide the browser Chrome and like watch the expression on their face. Yeah,
it's magic.
So it's pretty good, I think. Yeah. I mean, so far with Asm.js in the last year, we've gotten the performance from about 40% to about 67% within native. So depending on the kind of game, I played some that are really, really seamless. So we expect it only to get better, too. So that's kind of cool.
Cool. So the sort of goal is shipping a runtime in the browser. I mean, Firefox is sort of the champion of this, but the idea would be it would be in Chrome and in Internet Explorer, maybe. and you'd be able to write a game in JavaScript or in C++ and have it compiled to JavaScript. And then you wouldn't necessarily need to install anything on your computer or what have you in order to be able to play a high-performance 3D game. Which is
exactly
cool.
Exactly. And when it comes to Unity, for example, I think you know, right now I believe you have to install a plugin in the browser for Unity games.
Yeah, who wants to do that?
Exactly. And so with Unity 5, the thing that I think is really cool is that you know, nobody needs to install anything. It's just compiled to JavaScript and it's right there in the browser, which is one less thing for your end consumer, the person playing the game, to get it, what you've made, right? So
the one of the big kind of announcements there was that Unreal Engine, which is one of the major, I don't have a good sense, it's like, you know, is it the major engine or is it like top five or something like that? I don't really quite up to date on the vagaries of the competitive landscape for game engines, but definitely one of the major ones is they're supporting this platform. What's the kind of, is it out of the box? Is it something they're committing to do in the future? I mean, they have a demo. Is this something that they're like shipping their own games on, or is it kind of still unknown at this point?
So it's in Unreal 4 and it's in Unity 5 and ASM.js, like, for the web is a compile target there. So it's baked in. There are no extra plugins that you need for it. You don't have to pay anything extra. It's just available for you. I'm not an expert on all of the game engines out there. My understanding is that Unreal is one of the big ones, and so is Unity. The other one that I hope that we get on board, because that's three of the major ones, is Crytek as well, is out there. Just from walking around the GDC floor, I felt like Unreal and Unity had probably the most presence. Like, those booths always had lineups and people there and stuff like that. So my impression is that that's where the mind share is, at least right now.
Unreal and Unity are by far the two most heavily licensed ones. Unreal primarily sort of the big iron games, like lots of AAA stuff, and Unity's way more popular with indie developers, stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see. The big announcement, particularly out of the Unreal stuff at GDC, was that they've changed their licensing terms substantially, so it's a lot cheaper to get a hold of now than it was before. So it'll be interesting to see what that does to adoption of Unreal for sort of smaller games, but the verdict isn't really in on that stuff yet.
What's the minimum viable way? Like, if you and Angelina and I decided to, we're starting a game studio and we'd like to license Unreal, like in the past, it was like negotiating $100,000 licenses and stuff. What's available now?
It's I think an extremely small monthly fee, like double digit dollars, like $20 or something like that. Plus a portion of revenue. And I don't know exactly what that portion is, but there's no, like before, I think there used to be fairly large upfront costs for licensing the engine, like even in the indie game area, like thousands or tens of thousands of dollars upfront. Whereas now it's just like you pay some basic sort of access fee, sort of the same sort of concept as like an Apple developer account where you're paying a fee, but it's not really because they're trying to make money off that fee. It's more just to keep too many people from getting free accounts and sort of clogging up the system.
Just to
filter out the absolute lowest level of people that aren't even going to use it for anything. And then basically just like a percentage of revenue. So someone could make the decision to do a game with that with almost no upfront cost.
Okay, that's
cool. That was actually one of the more popular things at GDC, was hearing about that. And I think that the Unity pricing changed too. They may have done something different with their licensing as well. I'm actually just looking here.
There was a couple of them that changed their licensing. I think Crytek changed theirs as well. Unity wouldn't have to change it as much to be more indie friendly, because it was a lot cheaper to begin with, but they certainly might have changed something.
Oh, here was something really interesting. Walking around the floor, Nintendo had a section set up and they were talking about their web framework or SDK. So I wandered over there because I was like, well, that's new to me. And I spoke to someone there, and now what they're doing is they're trying to target people that have written web games to port them to, I guess, the Wii and the Wii U store. Perhaps the DS one as well, and then ideally bring those games into their marketplace, I suppose, so that they can have another platform to target. And then, I guess Nintendo makes money off of their game that way, being having them sold through the store. So I thought that was actually pretty interesting. From talking to Nintendo, I said like, okay, but what about bringing Nintendo games to the web? They're like, no, we're basically doing the opposite. We're trying to take all of the web games that are good out there and bring them to Nintendo. So I thought that was particularly interesting because they're kind of doing like the inverse of Mozilla in a sense.
Nintendo's going to have to be in a lot worse shape than they are right now before they seriously consider bringing their games to other platforms.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I know.
Just go to Mario.com and it's right there waiting for you.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was mostly just kind of teasing a little bit. I knew that was, they weren't actually going to do that, but it was interesting to see them trying to encourage, indie web developers and have that as a part of their platform. So that wasn't something that I'd seen Nintendo do before on like their console, at least. So
Does Mozilla have a philosophy on how the organization's goals are aligned with people taking web technology and closing it off like that? Because when people say, and this is sort of a discussion that's going around in the community the last week or so, is, you know, we use the word the web and we all sort of agree the web is a good thing, but not everyone necessarily agrees what the web is. And so to some people, the web is a page in a web browser that links to another page in a web browser. And to other people, anything that uses HTTP, like, you know, the Facebook app is the web because it uses HTTP, let's say. To other people, if it uses HTML and CSS, it's the web. And so to Mozilla, where your goal as an organization is to promote the web, does it sort of feel like, or do people feel like they're succeeding if it's like you're building tools and then Nintendo goes and packages them up and puts them in this piece of hardware that runs WebGL, but it's not in browser at all.
Right. So the Mozilla mission, you know, describes the web as this sort of inclusive, connective thing, sort of in the context of, the hardware in conjunction with the network being the internet and stuff like that, and then the web on top of that. Myself personally, I don't think that you can define the web exactly like that, especially now that we have more and more portable and wearable technology. The web is everywhere, obviously. So I guess that's pretty obvious to all of us. It was very interesting. I was in San Francisco just after GDC, and I was sitting with a friend of mine, and we were talking about the web, and he said to me, Angelina, do you remember when, you know, you were younger and you had to actually, you know, press a button to connect your modem to be online? I'm like, I do remember that. I remember that, the sound of the modem and everything. I love that sound. It's very nostalgic. And then we were talking about just how the web, how the internet, how this connectedness is just such a part of our lives that now, you know, you have things like your mail on your phone, you have, you know, Twitter, you've got Facebook, and you've got all these notifications, that now we actually have to take measures to, you know, press buttons, remove things, to unplug. Like, that's a really interesting thing, I think, for me to think about, comparing when I was younger to now, my experience of the web. I think about it as partially the technology, but probably more the relationships that the technology enables. And one of those things that ends up coming out of it is I think the creativity that gives people the opportunity to create games. So, I mean, when Mozilla's talking about the web, I mean, they're talking about, the internet and the web browser as a platform. Me personally, I think that it actually gets a little bit more abstract beyond that with the way that we use it, though.
Yeah, it's definitely the type of, especially when you get into this issue of ASM.js, which for those following along at home, ASM sort of stands for or represents assembly language, which obviously JavaScript, if you're a developer, you know that JavaScript is not assembly language, but sort of what if we treated JavaScript like an assembly language? But with things like that, you're really getting away from the sort of Tim Berners-Lee WWW concept of the web, where it's pages that link, and like hyperlinking is kind of the fundamental invention that made it. Like, that's why it's called the web. It's like a bunch of things that connect to each other, right? And so it's getting away from that, but, you know, in a way that doesn't necessarily diminish, you know, really to a lot of people, the web has just become the internet, you know?
Yes. I honestly, personally use those things interchangeably, even though I know that it's technically incorrect, you know, they've just become synonymous for so many reasons. So that is actually a very interesting point. And I think that, there's been some very apt criticism from web developers saying, well, you know, for Mozilla, people will, you know, someone will come up and talk about how great it is to port these, you know, 3D games to the web, and that's really cool. But the Emscriptum and ASM.js pipeline is really tailored for C and C++. Like, the average everyday web developer, there's not really a lot of benefit to them. So far, I'll be giving a talk actually at JSConf on our new web tools. And what I'm going to be doing there is actually using some of our new tools to step through some games and show people how they can improve their performance. And so one of the questions that people have asked me is like, okay, Angelina, like ASM.js, now what's the value proposition for web developers? And honestly, like, I don't have a good answer to that. Mozilla's motivation for that is actually to bring more people to the web platform. Obviously, we're never going to give up the idea of educating people and having people build on the web first. I think the idea is generally that the more people we can bring to the web and have them using that as a part of their everyday life for gaming, for, you know, utilities, for staying in touch, that's the general idea behind it. I do know that for some vector math libraries in JavaScript, they are actually using an optimized subset of JavaScript and typed arrays for memory, kind of like ASM, but as far as I'm aware, they're not specifically using ASM. And that, I think, is as close as people, or pardon me, that is as close as I've seen web developers, you know, writing games, JavaScript, HTML, CSS first, get to kind of doing something like ASM.js. They just sort of take the math and they'll use like this optimized subset to do the math a little bit more efficiently. But that's been it so far. So I, for like, you know, people who are born and raised on JavaScript, like, you know, myself, I was a bit disappointed as I learned a bit more about ASM.js to kind of find out that either it doesn't seem to be an upfront value proposition for web developers. Though from talking to other people at Mozilla, people who are a little close to the project, it's very interesting because some people who are like, no, Angelina, no, there's never going to be any value proposition for web developers. And they're totally okay with that. Me, I'm not. I think that it would be really great if we could find some application. I don't know who's going to be the creative person to do that. You know, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. But I don't like to underestimate the ingenuity of developers and people that are working on this stuff. Someone creative might have a better way for web developers to use it at all, I think.
Well, there's always the option to cross-compile different languages, right? Like C and C++ have been the focus targets for ASM.js, because they're the ones that you want to bring in, right? Games are generally in C and C++, so if you want to be able to sort of play with the big boys on having cross-platform games available on your platform, and your platform's the web, that means there needs to be some way to target it with C and C++. So, like you say, it's bring other people in, but there's no particular reason why other more web-like languages couldn't become targets for ASM.js. Like, you could imagine dialects of JavaScript that would have the same optimizations available to them that are available in to C and C++. Like, I'd be interested to know if some of the current compiled JavaScript languages, like, you know, CoffeeScript, maybe not, because it's very much in the same style, but like TypeScript, I think it's called, the Microsoft one, has a lot of the typing information in it, which is the thing that sort of prevents you from being this aggressive about the optimizations with JavaScript, right? So I think there's stuff there, and ultimately it never hurts to have the optimizer be faster, right? Like, the, you know, any changes that you can make to the core of the interpreter that you say, yeah, this is going to be faster in these situations, there'll be ways to exploit it if you care hard about it, right? Then ASM.js can become like the assembly language of JavaScript. That if you say, hey, I'm writing some JavaScript code, but it's not fast enough, I'm going to drop down to ASM.js and do a couple of functions in it just to optimize, the same way that, you know, back when I started in the games industry, that's what we did with C and C++. There'd be times where we're like, yeah, C and C++, just not fast enough. We're going to have to actually write this in assembly. And so that, to me, seems like the two ways that it can benefit web-oriented developers going forward.
There is so you're mentioning TypeScript. There is low-level JavaScript, lljs.org, which is another sort of Mozilla experimentation. And it's a typed dialect of JavaScript that has a C-like type system with manual memory management, and it compiles to JavaScript. And I believe it was James Long at Cascadia.js who did a talk on taking his low-level JavaScript and then, you know, compiling it down to ASM.js. So there have been some experiments done with that. In fact, in doing some research for my upcoming tutorial on this stuff, I got in touch with this guy, James, because, well, we work together. So I just asked him on IRC. I was like, hey, so LLJS is kind of interesting. I know it's an experiment, but do you know anybody who has written games with it? Because he also happens to be someone quite interested in games. He's written his own little indie type stuff. And He said, no, but it would be really interesting to see someone do that. And then we had a very short conversation where he said, the syntax and what we're doing with LLJS, it's an experiment. It's so much like C that I'd almost tell a programmer, well, take advantage of all the tools in C and then just go write C, because what you're writing here stylistically really isn't, as close to JavaScript as you'd be used to. So it's a very interesting middle ground to check out, actually. I don't really know if anybody's going to use it for anything practical, but it's like kind of closer to TypeScript and stuff like that in ways then.
It still blows my mind. And so C and C++ have existed, C has been existed for 40 something years. C++ existed for 30 years. And when I was learning them and I was learning to program as a teenager, and then I sort of used some C++ and then I used some higher level languages, like not initially JavaScript, but, PHP and all these various things and Ruby and Python. It was obvious to me, like as clear as anything, that C and C++ were outdated and that by the time I was in the industry, they would be dead. And no, if I wanted to make a game in 2010, when there's flying cars and all this magical stuff, that I would probably be using Python or something like that, or at least a language that protected you from doing things like accidentally leaking all of the SSL keys off of your server by making a typo around the entire internet and things like this. But we're still, we sort of as the games industry are still using C and C++, and mostly I believe C++. And the thing that's even crazier is when you have some of the initiatives that are closest to potentially providing a good alternative to C++ for games, it's not in the form of, okay, finally we have this, nice Python-like or Ruby-like language that has all these nice conveniences, but it's really fast. It's like, all right, so here's a way you can convert your C++ into a version of JavaScript that looks like C++. Why?
Yeah.
So well, I can explain to you why. the answer to why C and C++ are still in use in the games industry is fairly obvious, which is that there's basically no other language that provides the level of performance that they do, and you don't need that performance all the time, but you need it a lot more in game development, and making another language your primary language makes it very difficult to drop down, right? You can, the really big advantage, particularly of C++, is that modern C++ can actually be a remarkably high level language if you make good use of the classes that are in the standard library. You can get very close to, in terms of like safety and stuff like that, to high level languages, but you've always got the escape hatch to raw performance right there. And particularly the thing you've got in C and C++ that you don't have in most other languages, which is the real, the thing that keeps it alive now, right? Like at the time that I started in the industry, that was sort of good enough that just, you needed that extra 40, 50% performance that you get from being in that as opposed to being in something like Java. And you've got that escape hatch to like get another doubling or tripling of performance if you're willing to write stuff in like assembly and it's easily callable. You don't have to monkey around with crazy interfaces. You can just like in your C file start an assembly block and just start writing inline assembly and go. That's not as important anymore. But what has happened is that most of the up and coming languages have fallen down on threading support for the like CPU features, so things like SIMD instructions and stuff like that, and that's the stuff that's kind of keeping it in the driver's seat now. Angelina mentioned earlier that ASMJS is like 67%, 70% of native performance. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that that's 70% of single-threaded native performance, which means it's actually more like 10 or 15% of native performance, because any modern big game is going to be multi-threaded. Like, that's the only way you can get the performance you need out of it. JavaScript isn't alone in falling down on that. Like, Python and Ruby are terrible at handling multi-threaded as well. Java's a lot better, but Java is just as difficult as those languages to use like the escape hatches when you need it, and doesn't deal with stuff like SIMD or GPU computation and stuff like that. So that, you know, that's ultimately why C and C++ are still it, is you just can't get away from that performance. One more point to make about that stuff. The other thing that C and C++ give you that most other languages don't is good control over the actual in-memory layout of your data. So you can know by the way you declare your types where things are actually going to be in memory, and that's huge in terms of getting performance out of very large streaming data type of operations, to be able to actually control the memory layout so you get really good cache usage, and almost no other language gives you that level of control.
You can do things like, okay, here's what this entire level will look like once we've loaded it into memory. So instead of running the code that will load all of these various things, we're just going to copy and paste it from the disk into our memory, basically. And then it's like, all right, there's the level.
Well, you can do that, and that's certainly helpful, but that's not even the stuff I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about more keeping the CPU, like L1 and L2 caches, happy, right? Controlling exactly where things are going to be in memory at the micro level. So you know, if I'm pulling this data in, this is how much is going to come into a cache line while I'm washing through this enormous array doing something on it. And you just don't get that level of control in most other languages.
With the threading thing, either one of you may actually have an exact answer to this, but my perception is that languages like, you know, JavaScript and Ruby and Python, that, you know, traditionally have not come up in a multi-threaded environment, support threading. It's just that there's more overhead and there's less niceties around it. Is that not the case, or is there some like fundamental thing missing that can't be added into JavaScript that can make you be able to performantly deal with a lot of threads?
With ASM, I'm not totally sure. I happened to come in at the end of one of the talks at GDC where we were presenting on it, and someone was actually asking questions about, I guess it's pthreads. And I think that there's supposed to be attempt at future support, and we were kind of fuzzy on that. Research is trying to work on it, but I don't think there's a clear answer for that problem currently. I don't want to speak to that too much because I'm not on the Mozilla research team, on the DevTools team. So I don't know, but I do understand that, like, I agree with Nigel, that is actually the hard problem that we have to deal with on the web. And I don't know what the solution is in the meantime.
My understanding is that there's nothing sort of theoretically preventing it. Certainly not in the case of ASM.js, because it's something that is going to end up compiled down and not really be JavaScript anymore. I think most of the JavaScript interpreters have the same general problem that interpreters have. Like, this is sort of the fundamental problem with Python and Ruby, is that there's usually some fairly global semaphore controlling sort of the whole interpretation environment, right? That the actual interpreter itself isn't multi-threaded, or at least isn't multi-threaded within a single context. Like, oftentimes you can create multiple instances. Like, you can see that in like the JavaScript core API that's available now in iOS, where you can allocate multiple contexts and you can run multiple contexts in different threads, but each individual context can only run in a single thread. And that's just the limitation of sort of the way the interpreter works. And I don't think there's anything stopping people from a theoretical standpoint from implementing it that way. The problem is that most of these systems got their first implementations done before it mattered. And so they were written in a way where they said, like, okay, well, we got to support multi-threading just in case, but multi-threaded performance wasn't a priority. And so, you know, we ended up with default implementations that have these lots of semaphores lying around them, and some that have to be taken by almost anything that's doing anything useful. And that just sort of kills your performance. But my understanding of both Python and Ruby particularly, I don't know for sure about JavaScript, is that they support multi-threading with native threads fine in the sense that the code won't crash, like that there's no race conditions. The performance just isn't there because every time, you know, almost every time you do anything, it has to grab like the global interpreter lock and then all other threads that try and go into the interpreter will block.
I want to do a sponsor and then I want to change gears a little bit now that all of our non-programmer audience has abandoned Thread. And so we can get away with talking whatever we want, I guess. But to talk a little bit about what kind of games do well on the web and sort of the business models and stuff like that.
Okay, that sounds good.
So our sponsor today, this episode is brought to you by a company the two of you may have heard of before, is brought to you by Steam Clock Software.
Who are these people?
They're fine app developers in Vancouver, BC.
I may have heard of them, I think.
You may have heard of them.
Maybe.
So if you're looking to get a mobile app designed and developed, or just designed, or just developed, but ideally designed and developed, and you need a team who sweats every pixel, you can learn more at www.steamclock.com. I would say call now, but actually that's one of the things we started finding is that client leads, when they want to email instead of call, end up being just almost 9 times out of 10 better clients. So email now. Email now if you're looking for app development.
Also, we won't answer the phone right now.
Well,
because we're recording this podcast.
Right this second.
Maybe when you the listener, are hearing this, we're available. But even then, probably not, because we release it on Friday. So there's obviously lots of interesting things around games on the web and the technologies and the limitations and how close we can get to sort of AAA 3D game performance is a really interesting one. Another one I find interesting is this business model thing, where we have more and more, we're getting the tools to be able to make games on the web. And I guess Flash was the big game changer there, where you could put together something that was 3D and had, you know, pretty reasonable graphics and sound that would work on most devices, at least until mobile devices came around and started to, you know, put a kibosh on that. But there's still a question of how do you make money, right? Like if we're putting out a console game, then we have a deal with Sony, and then it ends up in the store, and then someone buys your disc for $60. At the end of the line, we get like a dollar or something out of that. And on the app stores, then you obviously put it up and people just buy it directly and you get 70%. But on the web, it's a lot less obvious. You know, we have games like Farmville, I guess, where there's basically in-app purchase and you can, you know, do some of these free-to-play things. But do you guys know of any examples of games on the web that people have purchased, or at least that like have some non-trivial amount of revenue from people who's just buying the game?
I think the only one I can think of off the top of my head. Oh wait, we want like a web-based game that was written for the web first, or
No, not even necessarily written for the web first, but like it's on the web. It's a web-based game, but in order to play it, you have to pay to play it, and that people actually do pay to play it.
See, I think I can't think of one that I've played personally. Most of the stuff that's out there is that freemium model that you're thinking of. I mean, I suppose that's really true for a lot of most of the games that I find in the iOS App Store. I mean, personally with the iOS App Store, I find that the ones that tend to be like the one-time purchase up front are oddly enough tend to be better quality overall.
Sure.
But for the web, I don't know. Like, that's the funny thing. I've never personally bought one, but I, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I like the idea. I support the idea, but I also have never personally bought one.
Is freemium even particularly successful on the web? Like, is there any charging on the back end either?
There can be for, like, often when you're, you know, you're on the web, there'll be like a side banner for some sort of kind of stock RPG game that you can sign up for. These games, they come and go and people will play them for a while. They'll like jump in and they're little like web-based RPGs inside the browser. And I understand that off of the freemium model, there is money to be made that way. This doesn't totally surprise me because there has been money made off something called Candy Crush. And
yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, like...
And Farmville is another.
Yeah,
Farmville created an empire.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it's not entirely a web game because it was so tied to Facebook, which I guess is probably that probably made the billing situation. I mean, that's always the thing with web games, right? It's the billing situation is what's really complicated. With App Store games, Apple's already got your credit card and you just got to type in your password and go, whereas any game that's going to get money out of you has to convince you to give them your credit card first. And I assume that Farmville had that somewhat easier by being tied into Facebook, that they were actually
I believe they started sort of off as they just did it on their own terms and then just said, all right, like put in your credit card into this form, maybe use PayPal or something. But they were basically just doing it the brute force way. But they built a game that people were so into, whether you want to say they're addicted or whatever, that people were doing it. And then eventually after a while, Facebook found it, like kind of realized these Farmville guys are making more money off of Facebook than Facebook is. Like, let's cut this out. And so Facebook basically put the strong arm onto them, which said that if you want to take money on Facebook, then you have to give us 30% cut and we'll do the payments. And then, you know, they basically had a choice in between losing all their revenue and giving 30% of it up. So
was that what kind of killed Farmville, or was it something else later on that killed Farmville? Like, did Facebook putting the screws in, was that what
I think it was just people getting bored of clicking on cows was what killed Farmville. But I mean, imagine it even still
bored of clicking on cows. Okay. So you want to talk about web games and clicking on things. No, I got the game for you. I was over at a friend's place earlier. We were playing a game of Civ 5, finished up the game of Civ 5. And then, you know, I come back from the bathroom and I look over someone's shoulder and there's this game called Cookie Clicker. And this was my first time seeing it. And there's this spinning cookie. And there are these tiny little creatures that were trying to eat the spinning cookie. And there's this number. And the number was just going up. And it said that the session of this game called Cookie Clicker, which was based entirely in the browser, that someone had acquired like 1 trillion cookies or 1 quadrillion cookies. And the main point in the game is to actually go and click on cookies. And as you acquire more cookies, you can then, I think, hire grandmothers to make cookies for you, but then you go through different iterations of grandmothers, and eventually you have so many grandmothers that you create a hive mind of grandmothers who can then make you more cookies. And this actually all revolves around like literally it's just a point and click game, and my friend was just like super into this game, and it kind of blows my mind that this is a really popular thing. But again, like Candy Crush is a thing. I mean, like a couple weekends ago, I'm sitting with my friend Jackie, and she and I are sitting there, and we're kind of just, you know, playing around on our phones. And she was showing me Threes because we had been talking about 2048, and she wanted to show me Threes because she thought it was a really well put together game. You know, considering it had been cloned a whole lot, she like was like, no, look at what these developers have done. It's really nice. And I said to her, like, have you ever played Candy Crush? And she's like, no, I haven't. So we both decided to download it to try it out. Man, like, if that, yeah, I don't know why I was surprised today at Cookie Clicker, because honestly, like, really simple stuff sometimes is what people want to play to, like, not have to be totally cognitively engaged with a game and just have the Skinner box gratification of, I click something happens. And sometimes that's all you need. I mean, even Threes and 2048 are an immensely simple concept, but I like to think that those involve a little bit more strategy than, I don't know. Just
so I Googled Cookie Clicker.
Aren't you glad you did?
My cookies are now popular in the neighborhood. I've recruited a grandma to join my team. A nice grandma. And
so goodbye to the rest of your evening after recording this. It's weird.
I figured it was a thing where there's a user interface and there's various types of cookies you could click on. But at least for the one I see, there's just a cookie and you click it. And that's the whole game. And then things happen as a consequence of how many times you click the cookie.
Yeah, when you get up to billions of cookies, it starts to get more complicated. And I was so fascinated with this. Yeah, they just seem to be into it. To go back to like the freemium model, I actually have really like lukewarm feelings on the freemium model. A lot of the time when I'm buying a game, I want to just kind of know the cost for the main piece of game content up front. I am not down on paying for extended content. I'm not down on paying for expansions or anything like that. I think it's a great way to get new content. But freemium is a little bit weird to me. Like in the case of Candy Crush, for example, I thought it was fun at first. When it's the levels start to get really, really hard and you're essentially relying on the element of randomness to bless you with a board that has enough colors and the right combinations to clear it in the number of moves that you need, it's very frustrating. So by the time, I don't know, I felt like by the time I got to like level 30, 31, I could understand how somebody who, you know, somebody who was frustrated really easily or really, really into like, you know, feeling the need to complete the game, maybe they're a completionist, pulling out their wallet to pay a dollar for five more lives when they can't beat it. But I actually really didn't like that because I didn't feel like I was paying for extra content. I was just paying to have some of the tools to get through the game because the way it's structured is very frustrating. Or if it's buying stuff, like there's been some other games I played where one of them was this is going to sound ridiculous, this quiz game where you dressed up as a magical witch and you travel through the countryside and then you battled people remotely by playing a quiz game. And every time you got a quiz question right, your magician would fire off some magic. And that was all well and good, and you would acquire more magicians for your party. It's kind of like an RPG. However, the only way that you could truly advance and get to the level of a lot of the other opponents was to actually spend money and purchase gems, you know, the in-game currency that was then converted into a stronger character. And it really stinks because, you know, you do play the game for a while and you get a little bit far in the storyline and you feel like you can't get over that. And a lot of the times these are freemium games, but sometimes you've already put in a little bit of money up front and then you hit a wall and you're like, well, why should I pay another $5? Now I'm also frustrated and I don't want to play this game. I feel like I wasted time. I don't get to finish the story.
The web is kind of really well suited for those types of games where it's sort of a net that they catch people in and try to convert them into money, right? Because it's so easy to say, oh, email 20 of your friends, and then they just click and they're instantly playing the game without having to, as opposed to if it was like, okay, they have to go to the store and buy this PlayStation disc and then go install it. Like, you're not going to have a very high viral coefficient on your free to play game.
Well, that was the idea with Monster Madness. So the guys Trendy and Nom Nom that did Monster Madness, Jeremy, the guy who worked on those games, came up and talked with us, and he actually talked on stage in the talk that I organized to speak of his game, because Monster Madness is the first 3D commercially available game in the browser, and you can play the demo. It's on there and stuff. And they had a really great success, actually. I think the story goes that they were sort of planning to, you know, use the web for advertising and just got, you know, then to drive people to their game, but they decided to give ASM.js a go. They managed to port their game to the web in, you know, a little under a week with minimal help. So they're like kind of like a, what's the word I'm looking for? They're kind of like the golden story case study. Thank you. Yeah, case study kind of thing. And then they said that they just found it really great that people could go to the website. They didn't need to install anything. They click a button, whether they want low-res graphics or high-res graphics, and then they're in the game. There's nothing in their way. They're in the experience immediately. And that's
I just clicked on that link in the show notes. It says I'm missing a plugin.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah, for seriously. Monster Madness?
Yeah.
The Playverse.com one? Let me try it.
The Playverse.com one, really? Because this is interesting.
I played it earlier in it. No, I'm getting music and a bunch of crazy stuff.
Yeah, this web page has content that requires the Adobe Flash Player plugin.
Well, that's got to be a lie somehow. Now, I wonder if there is a Flash version and there's also a web version, because when I was given a link to play Monster Madness, I don't know that it had been totally released yet. So there may be a Flash version. There may also be an HTML5 version in varying degrees of completion. Why they'd be shipping a Flash version when they're doing the ASM.js one, I don't know. Maybe they started with that and then somewhere along the line were like, hey, let's give ASM a go. The last time I spoke to Jeremy from Trendy, we were on email and he was thanking me for introducing him to the GamePad API because he had just added GamePad support for people to play Monster Madness for both Chrome and Firefox. And I'm actually just looking at their site now, and it says here, this ain't no April Fools. A Monster Madness Online is delayed, posted on April 1st. So apparently that is not a joke. So I don't know.
Poor Monster Madness.
Yeah, I was excited for that. It was actually pretty fun.
So Flash is
Flash, yeah.
Flash is Flash.
Flash is Flash.
And I guess it had a big impact on bringing games to the web in the first place. Farmville was a Flash game, and Glitch was a Flash game. Many of the various wacky, addicting games that we played 10 years ago with tossing things and throwing things and these sorts of businesses, all Flash game phenomena. But obviously, with the advent of mobile and iOS not supporting Flash, and now even Android doesn't support Flash, it's dying a slow motion death. And I think that's a lot of why people have been excited about games in HTML5, because it's basically, if you want to develop a game that works on the web on a mobile device, you either use HTML5 or you don't do it at all. And that's something that is really interesting and a lot of people excited about, but you don't actually have WebGL on iOS yet. Any speculation from the two of you about, is that coming soon? Is that ever coming?
It's definitely in Safari on iOS because they use it for iAd, and people have jailbroken and hacked it. So it's there. They just haven't enabled it. I'm not bullish on whether or not they'll enable it. I suspect that the performance probably isn't going to be good enough, but it could surprise me. Like, I think that's the reason that they've limited it to iAd so far, is just then they've got some vetting capability. I mean, they may also just be worried about the stability. Like, WebGL does have a certain amount of stability problems that other APIs don't, that if there's a buggy video driver, you could potentially take down the whole system with it, which is fairly unusual for a web API in terms of the worst case failure mode. But I mean, it's definitely, like I said, it's definitely there. They could turn it on at any time. It's just a question of when do they think it's going to be good for them to turn it on. And I think it's got to get, it's got to get some real traction first. Like, most of the WebGL stuff that you see is still demos, right? It's people like, hey, here's this cool thing I put together with WebGL, as opposed to here's a thing that is cool independently of the fact that it uses WebGL and you need WebGL to do it. And that's when Apple's going to turn it on, is when they're, you know, their users are missing out on something that they could have if they enabled it.
Yeah, it's just kind of, I see the trade-offs, definitely, but the fact that they've actually built it and it's there and it's on my phone, but it'll only display ads, like, isn't that the worst case scenario? I guess it's not on the web, but.
An interesting thing about crashing iOS, crashing WebKit. So there's a CSS property called backface visibility, and it's been so you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
There's this little property called backface visibility that people found they could originally throw on elements that would force some work onto the GPU, basically, and this would fix like flickering in WebKit and give you more fluid, responsive animations with CSS. And there were some tutorials explaining how to use that, but it turns out that if you use that and you use it a lot on a lot of elements, and especially on WebKit-based browsers on like iOS, you can actually crash the phone and have that be a problem. I was talking with some people earlier this week about like some mobile debugging stuff, and they were telling me that one of the biggest tips that they learned was it seemed like such a boon when they found this backface visibility, but actually it causes more problem or more performance problems than it solves overall. So we've actually already seen that just with like, you know, using CSS to get things pushed onto the GPU and having it fall over that way.
And that's a common.
And something like WebGL is just so general purpose in that regard that it's really easy to launch an intentional like denial of service attack against the video hardware with it. It's, you know, I mean, that's not to say that like, oh, WebGL is terrible and people shouldn't do it. Like, it's a risk that I think probably is worth it in most cases, but it's a new risk, right? You've never had until it an API that could take down your video hardware, you know? So people have to sort of consider that. And Microsoft was pushing back against it for a while, though I think they've caved now and said that they will implement it in IE10. Is that the next one? But
we're on 11 by now, I thought.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't really track IE version numbers, but
you
whatever,
don't? I'm
not
so
the
surprised.
One you can get now, but not the one you can get now, but the next one. I think I remember reading somewhere that they were going to do it, but they'd push back against it with that as their rationale. And, you know, probably part of it was just them not wanting to do it, but they're also right. It is an increased risk. But in the case of Apple, I don't think that's the main reason that they're doing it. I think it's probably just that they're concerned about performance. I mean, that's the reason that they kept Flash off, was just because Flash's performance was crummy. And WebGL, like, the performance is good for what it is, but that kind of stuff is, you know, is potentially going to be a lot slower. And if, you know, if the, I'm sure they're looking at it in the labs and like, yeah, here's a bunch of WebGL stuff and it just doesn't run very good yet, so hold on to it for another couple generations of hardware or whatever it takes, to the point where, yep, now all the stuff that's out there is looking pretty good, and so we'll turn it on.
So is that all it takes, is a couple generations of hardware, or are we fundamentally, because I would have said a couple generations of hardware ago is when this sort of switchover was going to happen, that, you know, HTML and CSS and JavaScript was going to be replacing native apps in terms of sort of developer productivity versus performance. And yet, you know, 2-3 hardware generations later, a lot of the, you know, obviously there's exceptions, you know, Firefox OS and things like this, but there's still at least as many native apps being written for performance reasons than there were a couple other hardware generations ago. Is there anything special about now that in a couple more hardware generations we're going to be doing mobile, you know, getting our mobile games rolled out on WebGL and things like that? Or is it something that's going to stay on the desktop for the time being?
Well, native's always going to be ahead. Like, the performance can't ever catch up to native, but the performance can get good enough that people be doing interesting things with it. And I think that's what it comes down to, is once WebGL has gotten real momentum on the desktop and people are doing lots of things with it, and maybe not even necessarily doing stuff that's games related. I mean, WebGL's good for lots of potential, you know, not game specific stuff that just needs 3D or needs really fast 2D rendering. And it, by two generations of hardware for the Apple platforms, I'm not even necessarily talking about like, oh, in another two generations of hardware, it'll be good enough. It may be good enough on the current hardware, but they need to think about what is going to get it if they turn it on now, right? iOS 7 still supports like the iPhone 4, right? So if they turned it on in iOS 7, then it would have had to run reasonably on the iPhone 4. So if
iOS 7 doesn't run reasonably on the iPhone
right.
4, let alone 7.
So if you know, maybe like the iPad Air and iPhone 5S level performance is like, yep, every WebGL demo that we threw at it in Mobile Safari ran fine on those two devices, then they can turn it on when those are the last devices that are supported, right? So it's not necessarily that we're waiting for new hardware to come down. Like I said, this is just speculation, but that's my suspicion, is that WebGL is something that's performance intensive enough that on the older devices, it's just not up to the performance target that they want yet. And when it is, they'll probably turn it on. Or if their hand is forced by there being some cool stuff that they're missing out on, they'll turn it on.
You are talking about other uses of Canvas other than games. The biggest thing I see other than games is actually data visualization. There's a JavaScript library called D3 that's used to create really compelling data visualization, really compelling charts, and then people actually use it because it's like a, you know, WebGL kind of toolkit to create just cool visualizations, and that seems to be pretty popular too.
Awesome. So I think that's about it for our topic today. Big thanks to Angelina for joining us. We'd love to hear your feedback, whether by email, hello@upup.fm, or via a review on iTunes. And see you next week.
So here's an interesting thing related to the C++ stuff. I was just reading this thing this morning. Let me see if I can find it to put it in the show notes. It's gone from my iCloud tabs, apparently. Apparently, they have dropped Unreal Script from Unreal Engine 4.
Interesting.
So Unreal Engine no longer has an internal scripting language. You now have to do all of your gameplay logic in C++.
Or isn't that maybe because everyone's using like Lua or something?
I was just gonna say, I thought Lua was pretty common for.
Well, but it isn't in Unreal Engine games. Like Unreal Engine games historically have just used Unreal Script.
Huh.
Hmm.
But doesn't Unreal 4 have the thing where you're like can modify stuff on the fly, where you're making changes to the world geometry and the constants and the gravity and stuff, and the simulation is kind of continuing without needing to rebuild?
Yeah, they've got on the PC, they've got some kind of like DLL loading system that they can do like live code changes and stuff like that. And I mean, there's all sorts of tuning variables and stuff built in, like communication between the editor and the game, where almost anything you do, you can see live in the game. That's fairly standard for those kind of big engines to have a really solid editor game connection, so you can kind of play the game and be editing the game at the same time that you're playing it fairly seamlessly.
Interesting.
What games are you playing, Angelina? Assuming you've actually had any, you've been flying around the world.
Right. Well, it's pretty interesting to me how what I'm doing at a given point in my life shapes my gaming habits. So, I mean, because I'm traveling so much, I try and pack really light. I don't like checking my bags. I'd rather keep them with me and take them with me on the plane. So that means, you know, carrying around like a gaming laptop so that I can play a really high performance game isn't a thing that I would do. Well, that's not true. I did do it. I tried it once and my bag was crushed. And guess what was crushed in it? So now I just take my iPad with me. And so I play a lot of games that are iOS games or sometimes web games that are like puzzles and stuff like that. But mostly I would say iOS games on the go. So I've been playing, I really love the game FTL. I mean, I started playing that on Steam, and then I learned the last couple days from flipping around in the App Store that they ported it to the iPad. And there's something about piloting a spaceship on a touch interface that's better than clicking your mouse. I don't know what it is. There's something about it. I feel like I'm in the future and I have my tricorder and I'm using it to do things like explore an environment. And I also think that, you know, they've actually released some new content for FTL as well. And they actually rebalanced the game, I think, to make it better. So I've been playing that the last couple of days. And because I'm on the go and there are so many, there are some games on the iPad that are pretty good with narrative too. There's a lot of puzzle games and short games and like compartmentalized stuff like FTL. But I'm trying to think of what the game was that I was playing. Hold on a sec. Like if you give me like 2 seconds, I can.
If it wasn't Monument Valley, then you're doing it wrong.
Someone just talked to me about Monument Valley today, actually, when we were having this conversation about games, and I was chastising someone else about Cookie Clicker.
Last episode was the artist and designer of Monument Valley came out and talked to us. It's only came out in the last week, so you shouldn't feel bad for not having played it yet. But
if you haven't played it in like the next few weeks, then you should start feeling bad.
Because yeah, it's like an hour long and very, I think you would like it.
Interesting. Okay, cool. There was one that I was playing on the iPad that was a 3D game. It was clearly a game that had been Kickstartered because there were a bunch of characters that said Kickstarter backer in the game. And I got to remember the name of it now. If you give me like 2 seconds, I'm going to find the game of it. Or, pardon me, the name of it. 1 sec.
Is it Republic? She's gone. It was probably Republic.
Right. All right. The name of the game is Republic. And it's a very interesting game. I haven't played the whole thing yet, but you start off looking onto this scene where there is this woman who's clearly a captive in these very military-esque people come in, and she's clearly done something that sounds basically like a thought crime. She's holding a book, and it's contraband. It contains some manifesto material that is contrary to the current empire that this world has. And so your character is sort of this omniscient presence that is trying to help this woman navigate and escape this terrible place, but you can only operate by using some special technology powers, and you switch around the view in the room and use the surveillance system. So you tap on the different cameras to actually navigate through the level and look at the level from different points of view and to figure out what's around corners so that, you know, the woman doesn't get into danger, and you can, like, you know, get, you know, show her where weapons are and stuff like that. So it's actually
this
cool
looks
game.
Pretty cool. I'm looking at the screenshots this
Republic.
Year. I'm going to be purchasing this.
Yeah.
Very soon here.
I was the Kickstarter backer for that, actually.
It's pretty decent.
The idea of more AAA games on the mobile platforms appeals to me. I'm trying to fight back the tide of free to play Candy Crushes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so it was actually kind of interesting because, in their Kickstarter rewards, the $10 level or something like that, maybe however much it was to get the game. And the reward that I was supposed to get was the game. But as an iOS developer, I was wondering, how are they going to do that? Like, because you only get 100 promo codes, and they gave away thousands of copies from the Kickstarter. I wonder what they're going to do. And turns out the answer was they actually screwed themselves and there was nothing they could do. And they ended up
A
series of emails saying, like, all right, we're trying to get you the game. We are going to try and do iTunes cards, but we don't want to send them to everyone. So, like, we're going to make the game like $2 for 24 hours and then try to give you $2 by PayPal. And it was horrible. I ended up just paying for it again.
Oh, yeah. I just found it because, again, like I say, on the road when I'm bored at an airport, I'll just go through the store. I mean, when I'm traveling, I'm carrying a MacBook Air with me just because I need to bring the lightest thing. And it's actually, I got to say, I am really surprised at the stuff that this thing can run. Because my gaming laptop is out of commission. I was playing a game of Civ 5 earlier today, and this MacBook Air can actually run Civ 5 okay with pretty high graphics. It doesn't chug as much as you think it would, so I'm pretty impressed with that. Civ 5 is probably the other thing that I've been playing a lot of because I do like turn-based strategy in a big way. So
you're telling me that Vancouver in Civ 5 has certain, because it's one of the city-states that has certain attributes. What were those attributes?
Yes, so I discovered that Vancouver is a city-state in Civ 5, and we are described in Vancouver as being maritime and irrational.
I think that pretty much sums
right,
up Vancouver right there.
Yeah. I was hoping to get Vancouver today as a city-state because I was going to take a screenshot for you.
That's awesome.
Vancouver being maritime and irrational. And usually we have like whales or pearls as a resource, which, you know, that seems legit.
Yeah, lots of whaling going on in Vancouver these days.
The pearl industry was actually where I started before I got into programming and got into tech. So.
Oh, yeah. That's we all go way back in the whaling and pearling.
It's getting too commercial now. Like people aren't whaling and pearling for the love anymore, you know?
Yeah. It went the same way that the fur trade went. I mean, who's, you know, not really surprised. So what have you two been playing? Like I say, I've mostly been playing puzzle games and Civ 5, and Republic has been the sort of more triple A type thing that I've managed to play in the last while with like a proper narrative, I guess.
I've been finishing up Assassin's Creed 4, which I'm enjoying being a pirate. The game is quite good, except when they decide that you should do an eavesdropping mission, which is that game's version of, okay, so you have to stay within 20 feet of this person, and if you get within 10 feet of them, they'll notice you and you'll fail. And if you get more than 20 feet away, then you'll lose them and fail. And also, they're just going to like walk through areas where guards will find you and you'll fail.
Yeah, the eavesdropping missions in that one are way worse than in the previous ones. Like, they weren't great in the previous ones, but I found them way trickier in that one. I ended up basically having to like plot out a route to basically get ahead of them to
win.
Like I couldn't just do it by following them. I had to like purposefully leave the area and like cut around the other side of things, and yeah, it was ridiculous.
The really crazy thing about it is that the game design inspiration for doing that is because they want to have you observe dialogue to tell the story in an organic way. So it's like, oh, if you hear these two bad guys talking about the bad things they're going to do, you're going to be like, whoa, yeah, those Templars are really bad. But I'm so intensely concentrated on not dying. Like, those are the hardest missions of the game, of just walking down a street and not getting more than 20 feet away from them. And I go into stealth mode, like, or detection mode or whatever, so I don't notice, or so I notice guards and stuff like that. And when you're in that mode, it kind of muffles everything, so you can't actually even hear the dialogue. So, like, I don't know.
Sounds like poor level design.
Yeah, and it comes over and over again. But the rest of the game is quite good, so.
There's not very many of those, as I recall. There's only, like, two or three of them in the whole game.
I just opened up my Steam account to remind myself of the other things that I've liked playing recently. And, of course, Steam has its update news window open up. And I have an advertisement here for a game called Broforce. There's a big silver star, and there's an eagle with, like, the biggest guns, like the biggest arms with biceps I've ever seen. So there's an eagle flexing, and then there's a bunch of bros. And, you know, I think I might need to play this.
That sounds like your kind of thing.
No, I think I actually need to try this. I think this is going to be that kind of terabad that I kind of look for sometimes. But as for other games, oh, one cool thing about GDC was there's Indie Games Awards going on there, Indie Game Festival, I believe. And so I got to meet the developers that did Papers, Please, they somehow made a game about bureaucracy fun. Like, stamping passports, I don't know why that was so enjoyable. But it was actually a really good game, so that was good. Have either of you played Ironclad Tactics?
No.
Okay. So, I mean, I like Magic the Gathering, so I love, you know, like, say, turn-based strategy. I love card games. And so Ironclad Tactics is a kind of collectible card deck-building game. You don't have to buy cards once you purchase the game. All the cards, you just unlock them as you play the levels. And you're doing this sort of simulation of the Civil War as if the Civil War had steampunk mechs. And so you've obviously. And so you have this deck of cards that you assemble with different mechs in it. And then, you know, every turn you get a new set of cards and you play them to put mechs on the field and you basically fight mechs with your opponents. And it's actually a really, really fun game. It's very well balanced. And if you haven't tried it, I heartily recommend it. It's in between the levels. You've got little scenes of comics that you read that have, like, animated portions to them. The soundtrack is amazing. Gameplay is beautifully everywhere I've played it. And they actually I'm just looking at it now, they just released a free update with more content. And they've done that a couple times, which I think is just like, I would have paid them more money, but thanks, you know? So I recommend that for sure.
I will return that recommendation. I gratefully receive it and return it with a recommendation for Hearthstone.
Hearthstone.
Because you like Magic, and yes. Hearthstone is like if Blizzard made Magic the Gathering, but better.
What? Okay. So, I'm open-minded, but skeptical. So Hearthstone or Hearthstone?
Hearth, like a fire hearth, fireplace. Hearthstone. Hearthstone, and we've talked about it on a few episodes of the show now, but the differences in between Hearthstone and Magic the Gathering and how the card game actually plays are subtle, but have a really dramatic improvement on how the flow of the game works. So in Magic the Gathering, you find, depending on the decks that both people are playing, you end up with 10 creatures in front of you, and there's 10 creatures in front of the other person, and no one wants to attack because they don't even know what the consequences will be.
Yeah.
And the games take like an hour sometimes, whereas a Hearthstone game takes like 10 minutes pretty much always. And because there's just a few little tweaks. So, oh, and other things like in Magic, you get mana screwed, where you have a whole bunch of things to cast, but no mana to cast them, or you have all mana but nothing to cast. It does away with that, so you just automatically get one more mana each turn, and you just do, and then it goes up to 10 and maxes at 10. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, it seems to kind of change the game dramatically, but the feel of the game is exactly the same, except that it cuts out that like 1 out of 5 times where you just lose automatically because you drew unluckily.
Yeah, that is very, very frustrating, and I am unfortunately all too familiar with that phenomenon. I'm just looking at Hearthstone now. When I Googled it, it came up with a Battle.net link, and I see here that it's in the Warcraft universe.
Yeah.
totally sort of related. I learned today that there's a Warcraft movie being filmed in Vancouver right now. Like a friend of a friend is being a stunt person in it. So they learned to go sword fight and stuff like that to be in this movie.
Is this a known thing that there's a Warcraft movie coming?
I don't know. Hold on like 2 seconds. Hey, Bill, you said Warcraft movie, right?
World of Warcraft.
Okay, so, I mean, a scientist told me, so it's got to be true, but, yeah.
That is a terrible idea.
It has an IMDb entry already,
So today I learned that there's going to be a Warcraft movie. That franchise is
Clancy
still
Brown is in it, so.
Well, then. The thing with Warcraft, or especially World of Warcraft, is that there's some really good or interesting or well-thought-out things in this game, in that game, and there's none of them relate to the storyline.
Like the gameplay in like 2 and 3 was good, and then...
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they'll surprise me, but I don't exactly play it for the... Not that I play WoW anymore, but... You know, it sort of loses any feel of there being an epic story going around when you are just in the middle of killing this epic dragon and like three more people are just walking away with dragon heads in their hands and three more people are running up to kill the epic dragon again. Like it's just sort of this, you know.
It's an assembly line of mob bashing and loot getting. The thing about, I mean, I was a very early adopter of MMOs, you know, when they were still in text form, and that was fun for its own reasons. I feel like, you know, when we've got all these games which are with rich graphics, and we're trying to have like this massively multiplayer thing. Like my multiplayer text adventure games were like at most like 10 or 20 people that wanted to play. Right, it's a very tight kind of little universe that you would self script and control kind of thing. And then you know when MMOs or when online games became massively you know multiplayer, like you know then all these developers have to figure out like okay, well everybody wants to fight the big dragon at once. I guess we need to make that happen because we can't get in the way of people wanting to play. And I agree with you. It definitely takes a certain something out of the fantasy element. Like I definitely play games to escape. And so when I came to MMOs, you know, years later after playing like these very sort of different style of multiplayer game online, I just couldn't, I've not been able to get into them. I tried Final Fantasy XI and I love the Final Fantasy franchise. I tried World of Warcraft a little bit, and even though that wasn't a franchise I had as much experience with, you know, gave it a go, still couldn't get into it. When it was in beta, I tried this one called MapleStory, which I believe came out of Korea, if I remember correctly, and that one I think is still popular. I got into that one a little bit because it was kind of like a Super Nintendo platformer that I'd played as a kid, but again, like after a while... I feel like in those games, there's some narrative, but not enough to compel me to interact with my peers about the narrative. And then I just feel like I'm playing IRC and killing monsters sometimes. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I'm just a bit traumatized from my World of Warcraft.
How much did you play? Like,
When I finally decided to leave it, people were like, oh, you should type /played and it'll tell you how long you played, and I didn't even want to know. It was like days and days, obviously. I played, actually, my family had a guild.
Family had a guild. I'm not totally surprised to learn that. That's kind of adorable. Okay.
My dad was in it, and my brothers, and three brothers, and my sister-in-law, and then we formed a guild with this other family who was like in Carolina, and their mom and their, you know, all of them. And so it was the two eldest sons on either side who sort of organized it. And it was
the family that raids together stays together.
Well, it was not that way because when you start fighting amongst the family about loot, it's like
the family that raids together hates each other and wants to kill each
God
other.
God damn it. I wanted those gauntlets.
Yeah. So it was fun for a while, but eventually it starts becoming obvious. If we're going to spend like 20 hours a week together as a family, like why don't we do it in person or, you know, not just making numbers get bigger. So
at least play the game in the same room or something. I don't know.
Certainly I have plenty of that playing with my kids. Like they're, you know, playing like new Super Mario Brothers or one of those with them is just, yeah. It seems like, hey, let's have a fun family bonding experience and play a game together. And it's like, why do you keep knocking me off? Stop knocking me off. Why do you keep taking all the power-ups?
Yep.
What are you doing? Where are you going? Slow down.
You can't go left.
Nigel, has your family played the new one on the Wii U?
New Super Mario 3D Land or whatever it is. Yes, we have. Yes. I don't know what the name of it is, but we have played it.
That one I thought was actually pretty fun. I felt like that one took little elements of both Mario 2 and 3 from way back in the day and kind of introduced them with a little bit of like the N64, just because it's in 3D. I actually thought it was really good. I didn't find it as easy as some of the other ones that have come out, but
I found it a little frustrating, actually, because the 2D Marios are very jumping oriented and kind of can be because they're 2D. Like, you don't have to worry about lining stuff up in 3D. And then the 3D ones were a lot more spread out and laid back, and there wasn't as much like really tight platforming. Whereas I found this one kind of struck a bad balance that way, that there was lots of careful platforming required, but you had to do it in 3D, so it was easy to like misjudge things or not hit the block that you were expecting to or stuff like that. Like, I don't dislike it, but I preferred like New Super Mario Brothers, the DS ones, and the New Super Mario Brothers Wii, like or Wii U, I guess, the new Super Mario Brothers one. Yeah. For the Wii U. Yeah. More, I like those ones more than I like 3D Land.
I hate 3D platforming. Ugh.
It's weird. Like, I tried to get into it on the 3DS, which that effect, the effect on the 3DS, just, gosh, it made me feel nauseous. I couldn't do it. But I still tried to play the one on the DS, and I found that one really awkward. Playing the one on the Wii U, Nigel, I noticed that a little bit too. I'm not terribly good at it. Platformers are not my strongest suit. I'm still better at them than other games. But the thing that I found frustrating with it is, I mean, even though you're kind of collaboratively beating the game. Yeah, that's what it was. Even if you're collaboratively beating the game, at the end of every level, there's like a tabulation of points. And whoever has the most points gets the crown. It is actually quite tough, if you are not a skilled player, to get that crown from someone who is even a little bit better than you.
I don't believe that I've ever gotten the crown. I think one of my children has always gotten the crown.
Well, I was playing,
because they play a lot more than I do. Like, they, like this one, I played it a little bit and then realized that I wasn't enjoying it as much as either, like, the real 3D, like, single-player ones, like Sunshine and Galaxy and stuff like that, nor as much as the 2D ones. So I was like, all right, I'm going to, like, they seem to be enjoying this, I'll let them play it. So they've played through, I believe, all of the game. Like, I think they've beaten Bowser and are now onto the extra content. And I just play with them periodically when they ask me. Whereas, like, New Super Mario Brothers Wii U, like, we just played through it together. So, yeah, I'm nowhere near as good at this one as they are. So they school me. And, of course, then Jack and Sam fight over the crown, right? Because you keep the crown on the next level, but you can lose it if you die and someone else can pick it up, and you can like, and they just get in like fights over the crown.
It's ridiculous. It's my crown this level.
I get in fights over the crown. Like, come on, it puts you ahead. I think the one game that I actually want to play next when I get a chance is when I was on vacation this summer. So it's actually been out for a while. One of my friends was playing the sequel to Link to the Past, the Super Nintendo era Zelda game. And she was playing it, and she just had such rave reviews of this iteration of that franchise, and said that it was a great follow-up to Link to the Past, which, again, I'm open-minded but skeptical because I love that game, and it's one of my favorite ones. But I think that I might play that. Apparently it's on the 3DS, so I'll have to like dust off my 3DS and pull it out to give that a try.
Yeah, Jack's got that one, but I don't think he's even played it at all. He's never really gotten into the Zelda ones. He's a Pokemon guy for his for his RPG fix. And I'm sure he'd like the Zelda ones. I've been encouraging him to play them, but he's never gotten into them.
I loved Pokemon for so many years, and then this last iteration, I don't know. You just know how when you feel like you're just done with something? I just felt like I was done with Pokemon because I'd played that game enough times that, you know, the narrative is not terribly sophisticated because they're targeting quite a wide range of audience when you think about it. Like, it was originally made for kids, and now they've got this whole, like, adult population that likes Pokemon, of which I'm a part of, but they don't really seem to cater to that population, which is very interesting to me considering how much buying power adults have compared to their kids, right? Like, I would love to see like a more adult oriented kind of theme Pokemon movie or game. I don't think it's going to happen. The games are incredibly formulaic. Some of those Pokemon, I swear they just dialed it in. One of the recent ones was literally a trash bag. I think his name was Garbodor or something like that. No, I'm not even joking.
A few of those.
Some of those Pokemon, they were really drunk or just dialed it in that day or gave it to like the freshest intern or something, because it's just, so I had to say no more Pokemon. But I can totally see why, you said it was Jack, right? I could totally see why somebody who's younger would still be into it. For me, I need like something a little bit more sophisticated. A while ago, there was like a little group out of Vancouver actually that did a very gritty, if Pokemon were done as a gritty movie trailer, and I saw it online and I got so excited hoping it was real, and like my heart was broken 3 minutes later when I learned it was some film students that had made that thing. The nice happy ending to that is I think those film students got a lot of notoriety out of it, and hopefully they went on to make good things. But it made me pine for like if they took the Pokemon universe and turned it into something that could have like an adult iteration or give it a bit more edge to it or something. I think that would actually go over really well, but I sincerely doubt that Game Freak is ever going to do that. So I'm out. That's it.
Ooh, I wouldn't suspect that's ever going to happen.
No.
Yeah, games turned into movies has not exactly been the strong suit of the film industry. So,
well, I mean, they've made lots of Pokemon movies. Like they make one with every game iteration, but they're kids movies, right? They're not like movies.
And it's not like a Pixar touching, you know, for all ages. When you say kids movie, you mean like only kids could appreciate this
type. Basically.
Yeah. I tried watching, because there's, you know, they have the movie and a series that comes out with every game. Like I tried watching one of the series because it's on, I think it's on Netflix. And one of my friends was like, let's just try watching this. Let's see what this is like now. And it just, nope, could not connect, could not relate. Too old for that now, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that also those sort of things happen when we get too old for something and then it dies out of its own accord, which Pokemon's stayed alive way longer than I expected it to. But eventually it becomes retro cool, and then they end up having, like, the Transformers reboot. Like, Transformers completely was off the radar and, like, no one was even thinking about it. And then there was long enough that they made a new Transformers movie, and it was, you know, less kid-oriented than the not that it wasn't kid-friendly, I guess, but less kid-oriented than the previous generation because we were all adults now.
I think the thing with Pokemon is that they've got their age range dialed narrowly enough that people kind of age out of it fast enough.
Before they get bored.
That they don't get bored with it. So they don't have to reinvent it, because by the time any given kid is going to get bored with it, there's like a whole new generation to pick it up again, you know? So I could see that one going on for a long time and not dying out.
I'm just reading the stats of Garbodor.
So without, oh my gosh, I actually looked up Garbodor because you just needed to know. I was going to say this, you might have spoiled it for yourself already, but I was going to actually say, without anybody Googling it, how many Pokemon do you think there are revealed all, like with all the games so far? Because remember there was the original, what was it, 150, 151?
Yeah,
I think there's 400 and some now.
Oh, I would have said like 1,000.
719.
Oh, okay.
Gotta catch them all.
I don't want to. That is too many to catch. I have other things to do and other games to play. And I'm not going to catch the garbage Pokemon, okay? Like, some of them really are cute, though, so.
Garbodor is able to spray poisonous gas and filth from its fingertips, but only from its right hand.
The flavor text for the Pokemon is always really weird or banal. Oh, so here's a really funny one. So I was hanging out with another friend, and she and I are hanging out there. We're talking about Sailor Moon. And I said, did you know that during like the Super Nintendo era, when you know, in the 90s, when Sailor Moon was big, that there was actually a host of Sailor Moon games? And she's like, no, I didn't know that. I was like, well, it's, you know, like I happen to have some backups. We should play them. And so I loaded my backups of the games that I had owned before, and we played them. And there was one that I guess I hadn't noticed before. It's called Sailor Moon, Another Story. And I guess what someone had done is capitalized on the fact that RPGs of the style of, you know, Final Fantasy VI and, you know, that kind of era or popular Chrono Trigger. And so it's kind of like somebody had used like a similar engine or like paid an artist on the side from those series to make like Sailor Moon sprites. And they created this game that we played for an hour, and it was the most poorly written game I think I'd ever played in years. One of the NPCs in the town, when you talk to them, literally just said, "Did you know that you can buy a lot of things at stores?" And I was like, are you kidding me? And then another NPC, and this is particularly interesting from a programming point of view, this other NPC said, "Are you lost?" And if you answer yes, it asks you things like, "Have you gone to the hospital?" Yes, no. "Have you gone to your house?" Yes, no. And actually, there's several NPCs planted around the city that all have this same decision tree in them, so the game can figure out what events you've completed. Rather than maintaining that somehow in the state in a better way, they actually have right. like a tree for you to figure out which of the events. And so that makes me wonder, like, I don't know why that wasn't done differently. Maybe there were constraints. I don't understand. But
so we played. The sage who's supposed to tell you what to do next is like, "Oh, I need to know what's going to happen next." And it's like, "Did you feed the dragon?"
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, "Did you save our town from destruction?" Yeah. I saved you out of the burning rubble.
This is exactly it.
You should
yes.
probably go find this guy then. It's like, and so you would know that.
And we played it for like an hour laughing at it and thinking, you know, like, okay, we liked this fandom when we were kids. Let's see what it's like. We played it for like an hour, and the whole like first hour of dialogue was people talking about how destiny was going to change. And I don't know if it was because it was a very poor translation, but there was another conversation where someone says, "Well, I feel that there's a dark force coming, and I think that destiny is going to be changed." And someone replies, "Do you mean the past will change also?" And the person says, "No, but yes, and also the future." And you're like, what is this dialogue? Like, I don't know. It was just super. We ended up like.
Here's the question, though. Do you think it would have been awesome if you'd played it back then?
Oh, well, of course. Yeah. Obviously. Like, are you kidding me?
That's always
13-year-old
the thing with those,
me would have loved
old games,
it.
Right? You play something old and you're like, was everything from back then this terrible and I just remember it better? I had an interesting experience the other day, which is that I played part of, I don't know if I'm playing anymore, maybe I will, of the original Tomb Raider. It's available on iOS now, and I got one of these game pads for it. And like, I need a game to play on it. I had got this big list of like all the games that supported it. And I'm like, original Tomb Raider. Like, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I just finished playing the new Tomb Raider like a month and a half ago, something like that. I'm like, yeah, I'll pick that up and give it a shot. And it's really not very good.
Like, but you loved like it back in the day, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, back in the day, it was incredible. But it's like, yeah, the graphics are like really crummy and swimmy and weird, and all the environments are really empty, and it's got character relative controls instead of camera relative controls.
Oh, that's horrible.
So like, you push forward and you go in the direction that the character is facing, not the direction that the camera is facing, and then you have to like,
oh yeah,
push to the right and rotate the character like there's some sort of tank that you're, you know, you're turning your tracks in opposite directions to rotate. And it's just like, it was a game I loved. Like, I loved all the original Tomb Raiders when I played them. And I go back and play them, like, I don't know if I can keep playing this. Like, it's the camera character control stuff in particular. Like, the crummy graphics, I think I could get past, just from a nostalgia standpoint, but the fact that the controls seem so alien now, I don't know if I can get past that. I'm too used to modern camera relative controls and smart cameras, and I don't think I can retrain my brain enough to play the game.
The future has ruined the past.